go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It's 7 minutes after 9. We're going to try to fire off at 9 a.m., so we had some late stuff come in for today's meeting. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, 2009. With me is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Elton, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, and Senator Thomas, and myself, Senator Stedman. And we're going to have to finish about 10:45 at the latest because we've got a State of the Judiciary joint session coming up. And we'll just kind of play this meeting by ear. If we finish it up early, we finish it early, and if we run late, we'll recess and come back. This morning, we're going to continue our review of the state's principal investment asset accounts. And this is an informational meeting, and we won't be taking any public testimony. Yesterday, we had an economic overview by Mr. Michael O'Leary of Callan Associates, who's at the head of the table right now. We took a preliminary look at the performance of the Alaska Permanent Fund. Before we get onto today's agenda, the Public Retirement Trust and the Constitutional Budget Reserve, we're going to start off with Mr. O'Leary on a few of his questions that came up yesterday. Mr. O'Leary, if you want to go ahead and reintroduce yourself for the record and then walk us through these slides that you've prepared.
Yes, sir. My name is Michael O'Leary. I'm an executive vice president with Callan Associates, headquartered in San Francisco. And I prepared responses to two of the questions that arose at yesterday's meeting, and others have addressed the remaining two questions. As I begin, I do want, if you'd indulge me, to make a very brief statement, because in reading the press reports, I didn't know whether I had been misconstrued. I want to acknowledge that we absolutely did not see the financial meltdown coming, and we were clearly incorrect in our view of the recovery. We had a lot of company, but that doesn't make it any easier to do. I just want that to be clear on the record.
Are you referring to the magnitude or the direction?
The magnitude.
Okay.
First question that we were asked to provide some detail on, or I promised to provide some detail on, was the composition of that universe of college and university business officers study, the Nkumbo study. And on the slide before you, you see that there were a total of 77 institutions that had assets of greater than $1 billion at the time of this study. And you see the distribution of all the other hundreds of institutions that are covered by that sample. You're asked for the policies, the dispersion of policies within the institutions, and the Nkumbo study does provide, on an undisclosed basis, the policy for each institution, but they don't segment it in a way that is easy to deal with. I have provided a copy of that detail to committee staff. And what is shown on this slide, slide number 3, is a rank ordering of the institutions listed by fiscal 08 market value. And what I would note is that only 20 funds had assets of more than $4 billion. And I think that that was a point that I tried to make yesterday. So if there are no further questions on that topic, I'll move to the second question.
Go ahead.
The second question was or second issue was a much more complex issue. And I had to spend a fair amount of time trying to put this together. The first part of the question asked, what were the Army's PERS and TERS policies back a couple of years ago, what were the expectations for those policies at that time, and then subsequently what happened, and what would have happened. And I thought embedded in that question was a very good point, which was, even though our expectations for returns from here forward are higher, they're not so high as to overcome what was lost. And I'll show you that in a moment. First, let me explain this page. Both the RMB and the Permanent Fund Boards annually formally review their investment policy. It gets updated as new projections are made available to them. They don't necessarily change the policy each year, or if they do, they'll change it typically in a very minor way. So I created a side-by-side comparison of RMB's policies for PERS and TERS and the permanent funds by broad asset category for the 06-07 fiscal year, the 07-08 fiscal year, and the 08-09 fiscal year, so the year that we're currently in. And then I maintained those policies for 09 to 10. Neither board has adopted a policy yet for 09 and 10. So all the difference there is simply a difference in the expected return from the lower starting values. So if we go back to the 06-07 period, you can see the expected return, five-year return, for PERS and TERS was 805, while it was 777 for the permanent fund. The biggest difference in policy at that time was that private equity had already been established several years before at the pension systems, and it was just in the early startup stages at the permanent fund. So that was a big explanatory factor in the difference in expected returns. You'll also see that the permanent fund had a heavier total fixed income allocation and no other real assets. In the case of RMB, that other category includes things like farmland, some energy investment, TIPS, and timber. So those four asset types are grouped together in other. In the 07-08 fiscal year, the policies for both groups were changed, but not significantly. You can see in RMB's case, the large domestic equity was increased by 1%. Fixed income was decreased by 1%. But otherwise, it remained unchanged. In the permanent funds case, there was the introduction of the other category. In the permanent funds case, that was a decision to establish an infrastructure investment in the other category. It wasn't funded at that time, but that became a part of the policy. And in 08-09 fiscal year, there really wasn't a significant change in either funds, but there were some minor changes. The absolute return category was increased for RMB, and the other category was increased for RMB. For the permanent fund, the private equity category target allocation was increased. And as Mr. Burns noted yesterday, that probably won't be reached, that target probably won't be reached for three or four years from now. So, but it is the policy target. And then there's no change, of course, for the 09-10 fiscal year because the boards haven't acted on it. So that's just the policy in place. Are there any questions about this before I move on to show you a couple of simple illustrations of what's happened?
No, I was hoping that we'd have the aggregate of the CBR.
Callan doesn't work with the CBR, so I have no information regarding the CBR.
Right. I'm sure we'll assist in that as we go forward. How's that?
Okay. The graph on page number 5 reflects if we went back to the beginning of calendar 07, now we're shifting to calendar years, and so begin with $100 and achieve what was then the expected return for Armby, it would have grown at a constant 8.05% rate, and that's the reddish line. The permanent fund at that time's expected return was 7.77, and that's the yellow line. And if $100 invested at the beginning of 07 had achieved that, this simply shows the calculation. The other two lines reflect what actually happened. So using the time-weighted rates of return for both funds, you can see in 07, both did better than their target return. RMB had a 10.17% return in calendar 07, and the permanent fund 8.9. But then, of course, we had the declines. In 08, the miserable results in 08, which were typical of other funds of this type, but no less painful nonetheless. And so that starting $100 by the end of 08 declined to $85 in the case of RMB and about $81 in the case of the permanent fund. Now there's an important note here that the RMB return for 2008 isn't complete yet. RMB uses another firm to do the real estate evaluation, and those results typically aren't in until probably next week. And so we've used preliminary real estate numbers to create an estimated return for RMB for your deliberation. My best guess is the fund should have been down somewhere between 22% and 24% is my guess, but exactly where I don't know. Okay. In both cases, in the bottom two cases for RMB and the permanent fund, I combined the actual with our current projection given their current asset allocation policy and just ran that forward for 5 additional years.
Could you stop there for a minute just to make sure I'm following you correctly? So did you use the January's actual and then started there? Could you clarify that a little bit, how you dealt
with
that?
Yeah, I used the $80.98 in the case of the permanent fund as the beginning value and then grew that by the expected return given with the new return estimates, which you'll see back on page 4. So for the permanent fund, grew it at 9% for the next 5 years.
Okay.
And in the case of Armby, grew it at 9.09%, given its policy mix for the next 5 years. Now, even with that, which is granted an optimistic assumption, but it is the middle of a range of what we expect. The result at the end of 2013 is that we returns that are comfortably above the $100 that we started with, but well below the numbers we would have gotten had we achieved the straight line results depicted earlier in the table, the 805 or the 777. So 2013, if our current estimates, projections were to work out, we still wouldn't be where we expected to be back in 06, looking ahead to 2013. Is that, anybody have any questions about that?
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then in that case, on the last column, 2013, you're comparing just using the numbers, 170, 194 versus 130, 149.
Correct.
Just rather complex. Yeah.
Now, obviously, nobody ever expects that you have no fluctuation in the rate of return. That's what Bernie Madoff got people to invest in.
Just trying to keep up with the numbers. Thank you.
So there's a significant change in the ending dollar value in 2013, in particular if you don't take into account the precipitous market decline in 08.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. That's pretty much, I think, the answer to the question that was asked yesterday.
It's a good point because there's a tendency for people to think, well, now they're expecting a higher return and we'll make it all up. The severity of 2008 was so great, that'll take a long time for it to be made up.
Okay. We don't want to talk about January so far. We're hoping things are going to change. Do we have any other questions for Mr. O'Leary? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think we handed out the request you had for the asset allocation, the target, and then I think that was as of 12/31, and then the most recent we had done, I think at the time, was February 3rd, just where we are.
And could you identify yourself for the record, Mr.
Burns? I apologize. Michael Burns, Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. Okay. And I gave these numbers verbally yesterday, but was asked for them. I think it's just important to reinforce now, as Mr. O'Leary said, we are in the process now, we'll start next week with asset allocation. And we have a capital markets assumption workshop with Callan, and then actually we'll make the allocations at the May meeting for the next 12 months. But I think even in light of what has gone on in the marketplace, there may be some changes, but they really will be around the edges. I mean, we are, a long-term investor. We have that benefit of that long-term horizon, the longest horizon, perpetual. It is clearly an advantage to us. Very, very difficult year we've come through, no question about it. As I think Mr. O'Leary said, we didn't see it coming, but with the investment allocation, if you'd have seen something like this with clarity coming, you might have done something different. But this is, this is the asset allocation we have, we do think is correct for the long term, but it certainly did not serve us very well through the fall, especially.
Senator Thomas, you had a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the example that you went through here, getting to 2013, do you have a projection if 2009 is as poor a year as 2008 was, where we would actually end up with that $100 at that point in time? Because if we anticipated $100 would grow to, in the case of the permanent fund to 168, and actually it only grew to 124. What would happen if there was another horrible year like that? Would it be under the initial starting point? It almost appears that it would, but I don't know if that's possible.
If there were another decline of that magnitude, I mean, we could.
I guess that's the key. If there were another decline, so
that magnitude.
Yeah, that.
And
you're straightening out my thinking there.
And we clearly, you know, you always are humbled by being wrong. So wrong. We don't believe that that's likely to happen because of the policy actions that have been taken, particularly in terms of pushing liquidity into the system. I'm not talking here about the fiscal stimulus plan or efforts, but that also will figure importantly in it. But I'm really focusing on the difference in the level of interest rates from where they were, and with the Fed's and Treasury's stated policy to provide liquidity, because what we went through was a shock to the system, a freezing of credit. And I really don't anticipate that.
I agree.
You never say never, but that's our expectation.
I agree. Thank you.
Just a second, sir. If we modified that question to not as severe as last year, but something in the magnitude of 10 or 15%.
Push it out further, sir.
Pushing it up or pushing it down. We're down in the broad market a little less than 10% right now. For the calendar year, and who knows what the calendar year is going to be until the end of the calendar year, but maybe you could, to help answer that question, maybe if we could get you to redo the graph and 409, take it down 10 and take it up 10.
Be happy to do that, sir.
Yeah, it'd be easy to do, I think, for you.
Yep.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. And this, you know, a brief answer, and if it's more complicated, maybe you can just get back to the committee. Mr. Burns, if I understood correctly, you were going to be making a decision on allocation in May, that, you know, after discussion with Cal and with others. And so your asset allocation decision would come in May. Can you speak a little bit to timing and nimbleness? I mean, given the rapid change in the market at the end of 2008, I understand that you want to make decisions in a careful, deliberate manner, especially since your goal is long-term. But isn't there some advantage in stepping up that timetable a little bit? Because I would assume that with all of the large institutional money managers, whether it's retirement funds in California or elsewhere, that you don't want to be on the back end of the investment curve. You want to be in the middle or toward the front end of the investment curve so that you get the better deal. So just briefly, if you could talk about the timing of the decisions to on your asset reallocations.
Well, Senator, the question of nimbleness, I guess it goes to the basic thing: if you're right, nimble, or wrong. I mean, you're really starting to go out on the limb of market timing. I don't think we're looking at different asset classes particularly. We may look at some small pieces underneath. A year and a half ago, I mean, when we say we didn't see this coming, and certainly the magnitude and the depth of what we've gone through clearly did not. What we did see was we thought some weakness in the credit markets, and we made, almost 2 years ago now, a $500 million allocation to distressed debt. Now, we had no idea distressed debt was going to get as distressed as it has. We were really looking at the credit cycle, not the collapse of the financial system. But there is some of that, and we're looking to create, and it's going to take us some time, an asset allocation, which we might, I think, for lack of a better word, just call opportunistic, that would allow us to move in and out a little bit quicker. But we're talking about maybe less than $1 billion. I mean, it would be a sub-asset class. But by and large, the big asset classes and the long-term view is, we think, what's very appropriate for
Mike,
us.
Could I just add, for I want to be sure that this is clear, that commitment to distressed was made 2 years ago with the understanding that the money would be drawn down gradually by the manager as distressed opportunities arose. And
it's
not fully drawn down yet. So it was anticipating, as Mike said, not anticipating what happened, but anticipating a more traditional credit cycle. Now, in addition to that, the active managers and indeed the permanent fund's own staff are constantly tweaking the assets in their portfolios to reflect their best thinking with regard to the outlook. So the bond portfolio may be lengthened or shortened depending on where they think interest rates are going to go over the shorter term. The global equity managers may be shifting money from abroad to domestic. They have the latitude to do that, and that's part of their mission. But deciding how much money is given to them is on the board's shoulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Still need a little bit of assistance, I think, when we look at the difference between the ARM board allocation and the permanent fund allocation, and we look at their time horizons and their volatility measure here, their risk level is several years ago when we were working on the retirement system, we were asking why the retirement system has a higher targeted rate of return and or expected rate of return over 5 years and a higher volatility than the permanent fund when the permanent fund has a much longer time horizon and doesn't have the demand on the liquidity side of it that the retirement system has. Clearly, there's a dividend issue every year that fluctuates and may or may not get paid. But we will pay the retirees every single year, regardless of what goes on. So help us understand why the permanent fund doesn't have a higher risk level and a higher targeted return than the retirement accounts.
I think that it's an excellent question, Mr. Chair. The movement at the permanent fund has been toward the higher return, higher volatility, reflecting exactly the point that you made, that it is the most permanent of the pools with the least in long-term liquidity requirements. It had been more conservative primarily because of the legislative restrictions. And as that was reduced or eliminated as a controlling factor, the fund has, in a very prudent, evolutionary manner, begun to close that gap. This is one of the reasons why I showed the Nkumbo information. And if you compare those large funds, those large endowment funds, you'll see that they are almost across the board, certainly on an average basis, they are more aggressive than the permanent fund. but there are a real limiting factor in the permanent funds case is the limitation on the payment of dividends or of any distributions. I know the legislature determines what the distributions are used for, with regard to earnings reserve. So that has been a factor that has been a part of the, in my opinion, a part of the thinking of the process. But clearly, the permanent fund, as the private equity exposure gets funded, will be much more similar to the pension systems. Now, with regard to the pension systems, particularly with the changes that were instituted a couple of years ago, at some point in the future, the investment policies will begin to become more conservative. If they do, they will clearly have a lower chance of achieving the actuarial earnings assumption of 8.25%, which equates, given our expectations, to a real return of more than 5.5%, which requires a very heavy equity commitment to have a chance of achieving. Now, the funds, the systems, of course, as you all know, are significantly underfunded, have been for some time. And so the expectation is that they will be in a net inflow position for a protracted period. But somewhere down the road, 7, 8, 9 years from now, it would be my best thinking that the policy will begin to have to become a little bit more conservative because the liquidity needs of the system will be growing.
Do we have any other questions for Mr. O'Leary? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you explain just a little bit on the concept that if you have an actuarial assumption of 8.5, that equates to the 5.5 in reality? I'm not quite sure.
Our longer run inflation estimate is 2.75. So I'm simply subtracting that from the 8.25. Now, the actuaries, and this is the norm across the nation, I don't think, and certainly with the review of the actuaries' work that is required on an annual basis, that I think should give you confidence that this is the norm. There is an embedded inflation assumption in the actuarial valuation that's higher than our expectation of 2.75.
Okay, I got
and that affects the ultimate level of benefits in the defined benefit plan, and of course it affects retiree medical benefits.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. O'Leary or Mr. Burns? Thank you for coming in yesterday and today, and hopefully you'll hang around here for a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We're going to move on now to another topic. We're going to talk about the Public Retirement Trust Fund and the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We're going to have to present Mr. Jerry Burnett, that's been here numerous times, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, and Mr. Gary Bader, who comes in on occasion, Chief Investment Officer. You want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and then we'll...
I'm Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
And I'm Gary Bader. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, we have a short presentation today to kind of go through the investment process used by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And I say it also applies very closely to what the Commissioner of Revenue does in terms of setting allocations
for the more than 40 separate funds that we manage and have asset allocations for within the Department of Revenue.
If we could, when we walk through this, I think the discussion point is on the Constitution of Budget Reserve and its policy procedures versus the Public Retirement Trust. And the interest with the Retirement Trust is just kind of quick update on its performance and its status on the market value side versus the liability side because of the delay and the magnitude of the financial correction that we've gone through that Mr. O'Leary alluded to and the change in the ending dollar value of portfolios in the future that was referenced earlier in the meeting. Just to help you put a point on what we're doing here.
Be happy to do so, Mr. Chair, and we will begin with discussing the retirement funds and then into the constitutional budget reserve. On the next page, Jerry. Mr. Chair, this page kind of outlines the number of resources available to the ARMB, Alaska Retirement Management Board. The Retirement Management Board has the uses the staff of the Department of Revenue as its investment arm. Available to the board is an IAC, which stands for Investment Advisory Committee, and those are three individuals we'll talk about later. It also has a general consultant, which is Mr. O'Leary. The CIO is Chief Investment Officer. That's myself and my staff, and we exercise control over external asset management of funds, asset managers, and also we manage about $16 billion internally, of which about $2 billion of that is Retirement Management Board fixed income. We have fiduciary responsibilities, and I won't read them all to you, but just quickly, our intent is to consider the fund's investments and liabilities as we make asset allocation decisions. There are nine members on the ARM board. Two of the members are they're all statutory, but are members of the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Administration. There are two representatives that have retirement interest in the public employees retirement system, the teachers retirement system, and then there are three other members of the board. One of them is responsible or must be involved in municipal government in the state of Alaska as a finance officer. Then there are two other members as well. Next page. We do have a consultant, which is Mr. O'Leary, and he provides advice on asset allocation and the strategies, helps us measure the performance of our investment managers, and provides general consulting on a variety of topics that come up from time to time to the board, which may be securities lending or asset liability studies in terms of our investment of the fund and what our asset allocation should be, given the nature of the funds. And we are talking about primarily about PERS and TERS and the legacy systems that are in place, which, as we all know, are no longer being growing in their membership, and they have a limited life at this point. And so asset liability studies will become more and more important as we progress over the years. Next page. Investment Advisory Council has three members. By statute, the board is permitted to have up to five. The legacy board, the ASPIB, had three members, and the ARM board decided to continue. These members add valuable insights, complement the advice we get from Mr. O'Leary and our other real estate consultant. The members are Dr. Gerald Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell was he's a graduate of Harvard Law School, I believe, was an investment manager for Wellington Fund, running an international equity portfolio. He later became chief investment officer of Massachusetts Retirement Funds, then the Boston Fund, and currently serves as an investment officer in a private office. Dr. William Jennings has a doctorate degree in finance. He's a CPA. He teaches finance at the Air Force Academy, and serves on as an investment advisor on other to other funds. George Wilson is a CPA, former real estate officer for Mass Prim, and is currently the chief investment officer of the Boston Fund. The asset allocation decision is driven by a number of issues, but listed before you are the main things that drive the asset allocation decision. One is the investment objective of the retirement system. What are we trying to accomplish? Mr. O'Leary alluded to the fact that the ARM board's actuary is operating under the assumption that the fund earned a net return of 8.25% over the long run. In terms of how we will get to that over the long run, the board must take into account its risk tolerance, the expected return of each asset class, how well those asset classes move with in concert with one another, and we'll have more to say on that in a page or two. Turn the page. This gives an idea over the long run of how the various asset classes perform. The y-axis, the up and down axis, shows the investment returns of these asset classes over a long period of time, 1926 to 2004. The bottom axis, x-axis, is risk, defined as standard deviation. And standard deviation is another term, statistical term, for the volatility of the returns. Next page. Speaking a little bit more about standard deviation, what does that mean? You know, it's a term used all the time. Some members may not be accustomed to hearing this term. So we have a what we used to know in school as the bell-shaped curve, and what this is showing is the impact of standard deviation. So if we tell the committee that the expected return is 6% with a standard deviation of 9, that means one standard deviation on this is plus or minus one is represented by blue on this graph. So if your expected return was 6 and your standard deviation was 9, you could say, well, if one standard deviation event occurred, we could lose 9 from the expected return of 6, or a minus 3. If it was a positive standard deviation, it would be 6 plus 9, or a return of 15. Highly unlikely events are way out on the ends of this graph. They're called, frequently referred to as fat tails, events that seem to have a low probability of occurring, but somehow occur more than we would like them to. Next slide, Chair. This is a another, this is not Mr. O'Leary's capital market assumptions. These are just here for example. But when we talk about the correlation of returns, how well do assets move with one another, the way this table should be read is we would look at large stocks, and we see how well do large stocks move with large stocks? Well, they move perfectly. A correlation of plus one means they move together. The range of correlations can be plus one to minus one. Minus one meaning they move exactly opposite one another. So when the board and Mr. O'Leary and our IAC are looking at asset allocations, they are taking into account what is the expected return of an asset, what is the volatility of returns, and how well do these returns move in conjunction with each other. The product of that exercise is what is known as an efficient frontier. An efficient frontier is a series of expectations where one would determine the highest rate of return that one could expect to get for the lowest amount of volatility. And in our example here, we have a 100% cash portfolio, very low return, very low volatility, safer, if you will. Or if we look at E on the slide, 100% stocks might be a far greater return with much more volatility. This is the asset allocation of the ARM board for the PERS and TERS legacy funds right now. This is a target allocation. Markets move. We're not always on the target. The board establishes certain bands, which it directs the chief investment officer to stay within. So there is volatility within these assets. The market goes up one day. We don't automatically rebalance the fund because there's a cost of doing that, or the same if the market goes down. But we do make those determinations, and we follow our asset allocation and rebalance. Next slide shows these are September returns. We don't, as Mr. O'Leary said, we don't have our final returns for December because some asset classes are the returns are based on appraisals, and those appraisals are not complete and not in. Real estate, for example, is one that is slowest to come in. But this is where we were in September, looking at a one-year return, the previous September to the end of last September. And so that return was a negative 12.89%. How would it have come out if we had been exactly on our target return? Well, it turns out we would have had a negative 14.51%, but our investment managers did better than one would anticipate if one just used the index or benchmark that was established for them. So we had a net manager effect that was positive, and that's why our return was better than the target return. This shows the performance of our pension funds, the retirement, the PERS and the TERS. This is PERS, I believe, relative to the Callan database of public funds. And just a little bit on this, we could say that, and this once again is September to September, the during that 1 year, we were in the top 23% of public funds. Now, if we were to be number one, I think you would have some cause for alarm, because in order to be number one, you must be at the extreme of your investment process. So if it had been since it was a down year, if we'd been all fixed income, we'd been probably close to number one. But really, if you look at years two and three, those represent years where of up markets and down markets, and what we are attempting to position our portfolio for is to be have good returns, top quartile or top third in both up and down markets, and at least for the last 3 years, we've accomplished that. We understood that the chair had asked for some information related to the what is the impact of the downward market on the expected rate of return and the earnings assumption of the PERS fund, for example. We use 2007 as the base. Now, this is different than Mr. O'Leary's, and that's why you will find he started at 2006 and used a slightly different earnings assumption than we did. But using the end of 2007 and then assuming that the portfolio has a negative 22.24%, how does this compare with what we were hoping or what the actuary is planning for the retirement systems to do over that period of time? The actuary is assuming that we're going to earn 8.25%. So if we start out down 22% and add to that the 8.25% that the actuary thought we were going to earn, now we're down 30 versus the actuarial assumption. How much do we need to earn in 2009, and this is calendar year, to get back to getting on our 8.25% assumption for 2 years? And our estimate is that we would have to earn 50%, a very unlikely outcome. And we show that on the top graph shows that it's a less than 1% probability that we will get back to on our earnings assumption if we use the beginning of 2008 for our base year. Fortunately, we did have some years where we had surpluses in 2007 and 2006.
Mr. Bader, could you? I was under the impression that the actuarial target was 8.25, and the portfolio target was 8.11.
Yes, the 8.25% is the actuarial assumption over a long period of time, 30 years generally. There's always been a difficulty reconciling what might be the ARM's target return. So we get back to looking at what is the real return. The actuary is looking at an inflation assumption of 3.5% over the next 30 years. Mr. O'Leary or Callan's current inflation assumption is 2.75% last year and this year as well, I believe, this coming year. So there's a disconnect in terms of looking at nominal returns. I think if we were graphing this chart in terms of real returns, I think we'd be very close to what the actuary was looking at. Not exactly, there is a disconnect, but we would probably be looking a little bit, in terms of real returns, looking a little bit aggressive in terms of what the actuary might be planning for us, but not by much.
When we, it's kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but when we have the updated actuarial analysis, I'm sure we're going to be asking about the 8.25. It appeared a couple of years ago that it might be on the high side within the universe of some of these type plans. So we'd like you to come back with some response on that issue at that time.
Okay.
Or I'll have the ARM board do it or what have you. But there is some concern that the market dynamics are moving away from the 8.25, and understand as that rate comes down, the liability gap goes up. And there is some concern that we, there's just some interest in it, put it that way, and we'll deal with it at the time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
The next graphic, Mr. Burnett will take over from this point.
Okay, one of the, for the record, Jerry Burnett again. One of the things you asked about was to compare all the major funds that are under either the permanent fund, the ARM board, or the Commissioner of Revenue, and what their asset allocation are, what their purpose, market value on 12/31, market value now, so for the past year. The first fund on there is the general fund, and you'll see that its market value fluctuates, but primary difference in market value on the general fund is appropriations in and revenue. Appropriations out and revenues in. So the 3-year actual returns on that were 5.29%, and it's all in fixed income, short term and intermediate term. Has a current balance approximately a little over $7 billion.
So if we could just stop there just so we follow along. A calendar year return is what dates?
The calendar year was the 2008 calendar year.
Correct.
Okay, and define what you're using as a short-term definition and an intermediate-term definition so we follow the links. And I'm sure that I assume the definitions are the same throughout your sheet.
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Chair, in terms of the short-term fund, is generally the same type of investments that one would find in a money market fund. There is some opportunity to go a little bit longer duration, but it's essentially a 90-day plus account, but there are some longer duration investments in there. The intermediate term uses the Merrill 3 to 5 year treasury as its benchmark, so it's less than 5 year duration on the intermediate term.
So if I looked at the holdings, I would see holdings beyond 5 years?
Not in.
Because there's a difference between duration and length of.
In terms of maturity?
Right.
Yeah. There are some mortgages that reset, okay, because when you calculate the expected maturity of mortgages, a mortgage portfolio, and we might be getting in the weeds more than we want to here, but as interest rates go down and people refinance their homes, then that mortgage portfolio will probably pay back quicker. If interest rates go up, it could extend in terms of length. So when we talk about portfolios that have asset-backed securities in them, it's subject to interest rate volatility. So it could have investments over 5 years, depending upon the interest environment.
Okay.
And I'd just like to make one point on what we call the general fund. It's JFONC. About $4 billion of that $7 billion is money that's restricted. It's the things like the public school fund and other account, the account for tax credits, other accounts of that, those types, listed funds. So those are not, there's about $3 billion of that, which is unrestricted general fund, and the balance of it is other funds.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in that general fund category, that's where the SBR exists?
Yes, the SBR also sits in that. There's $1 billion. And that would be in the $4 billion, you know, in the other.
And how do you treat the SBR internally?
The SBR is a part of JFONC for investment purposes. The earnings from the SBR flow to the general fund unless otherwise appropriated by the legislature.
I mean, just for the folks at home, because we get a lot of moving parts here, but the statutory budget reserve was funded last year with $1 billion.
Correct.
Of excess revenue, and we set that aside. It takes just a simple majority vote of the legislature to access those funds. The earnings, my understanding is the earnings then accumulate to the general fund.
Correct.
And also the losses.
Yes, that would be correct. That would maintain a balance of $1 billion regardless of investment performance of JFONC.
Explain to me how this works. Is this commingled within the general fund?
Well, it's invested for investment purposes. It is handled as a part of JFONC, and it's the investments are all together, are all commingled. Yes.
So can you identify a particular return or a particular loss on this?
We can identify it as a portion of the general of the JFONC portfolio and allocate on that basis. It does not have a separate asset allocation or target return.
Right. Okay.
Okay. The second fund on here is the Constitutional Budget Reserve Main Fund. That is our, you know, short-term constitutional savings account. It's invested for moderate risk, intermediate investment horizon. It's 100% fixed income. Short term is 5%, intermediate term 75%, and a broad market at 20%, all fixed income. It has a calendar year return of 5.67% or 08, and a 3-year actual return of 5.71% with a forecast return of 4.53%.
Okay. And define for us, we're following you, when you say moderate risk and intermediate investment horizon, what are you saying?
Moderate risk would be, you know, it's not, it's in all in fixed income, low volatility, and it had the intermediate investment horizon is one that we would use for less than 5 years, something that you could appropriate next year and be fairly certain that you'd have the amount of money that you need, that's in it now, or fairly similar. You wouldn't expect any large losses.
So what is the duration on this account? Do you happen to know that, or rough idea what that is?
Well, it's with that asset allocation, which is, you know, short term is the 90 days or less, 75% is the intermediate
Mr. Chair, the target asset allocation is 37% short-term investments and 63% intermediate terms. Our calculation using the Callan capital market assumption.
Stop there. Could you repeat that?
Oh, yes, sir.
On the short term, Mr. Baker.
The short term, 37.
Okay.
CBR main.
We're on CBR?
Yeah,
CBR we're on CBR main account.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were on JFONC. The main account of CBR was 20% broad market, 75% intermediate term fixed income, and 5% short term fixed income.
And as we walk through this, some of the conversations, you know, we haven't decided as a body yet how we're going to respond to the revenue projection decline, and what accounts we're going to fall back on to meet our liquidity needs. It appears that we're going to need $1.3 billion for FY09. There's a high likelihood that we're going to go to the CBR to get it. FY010, at $50, we're looking at oil, if it turns out to be $50. It's about a $2 billion deficit. That puts us at about $3.3 billion, which pretty much liquidates, if we go to the CBR, the main fund. And so some of the concerns that some of us have, the creation of the policy and the implementation of it is one set of conversations. The other set is, what are we doing to structure ourselves so we don't get into a particular position that makes us uncomfortable liquidating holdings we don't want to liquidate?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the CBR main account would be very liquid at this point. We would be able to liquidate it at the stated value almost certainly in a fairly short period of time. And it's invested to not, you know, to reduce the risk of losing value over the period. One thing to consider, though, since you look at things at an appropriation level, we look at things at a cash and as your bank. Well, you make an appropriation from the CBR and you think of it as the beginning of fiscal year 09, the money, the cash, probably won't be drawn out until some period in the future beyond that. So we're looking at, you know, several months or maybe as much as a year lag between the actual need for cash from that account as compared to matching appropriations to meet that need. So I don't think we have a real liquidity issue in any of these accounts, especially with the current liquidity in the general fund.
I don't think there's a question of liquidity.
Okay.
The question is market value when you liquidate.
Right. And that's why, as I said, the CBR is managed to reduce volatility, the main account. The next one on here, and I think this is the one you're most concerned about, is the Constitutional Budget Reserve subfund, which has a value currently of just over $3.4 million approximately. It is a fairly high risk, moderately long investment horizon. Has an asset allocation of 37% fixed income, 44% domestic equity, 19% international equity, and I believe it also has 1% of emerging market debt or international debt allowable in it. It has a statutorily 5-year investment horizon. And what the statute says is that in setting the asset allocation for this, the commissioner should consider that this money will not be used for a period of 5 years.
And we're going to stop there for a minute. We will have a few questions. I see the commissioner just left. It's kind of unfortunate timing. So we may take a recess because he really needs to be here when we talk about the policy of this issue. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'd said in the subfund of the CBR that value today is $3.4 billion?
Approximately.
And that is as of when?
That was as of 1/31/09, not as of today, because the market actually has moved in both directions since then. And
so in the you know, and that was one of the questions that we'd asked earlier, saying that the fund is, as of December, has been and projected to make money, but it has lost a little under $200 million since December 31st.
I think that would
$90 million.
I believe that would be correct. It is invested, as I said, with a 5-year time horizon. It is fairly high risk, and the calendar return was nearly 30% negative.
When we had the commissioner here, that was a question that I asked, and the projection was for the remainder of the fiscal year that I don't have the exact number, but it was a substantial positive number, and he did not know at that point what the if in fact we had positive investments, positive returns for the first 30 days, but that was the inclination, I guess, that we had received from the commissioner, and now we learn today that it had lost $190 million in the first 30 days of the second half of the year, fiscal year.
That is correct, and I'm not sure that what it was on the day that the commissioner was here, because we have had
last week, wasn't it?
Volatility.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is we're going to stand in recess to the call of the chair. The commissioner really needs to be here to discuss this policy question, not only how it was implemented, how the department plans on dealing with it in the future, and there is concern on our fiscal position that we don't want to be backed into this particular portion of the CBR.
Yes, we understand that, and I'm sure the commissioner would be happy to come back and discuss it.
We'll stand in recess to the call of the chair. on the third floor of some substantial permits.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Dealing with other issues. So a man of many hats. Mr. Commissioner, if you can identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and we'll get rolling.
Sure, Mr. Chair. My name is Pat Galvin. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Revenue.
We have, as you know, walking through the CBR, and we've gone through the one component part, the main fund, and then we're now talking about the sub-account. And, we left the main account with the potential of a virtual entire elimination of it, dealing with the FY09 and FY10 budget if we have $50 barrel oil. And I recognize that there hasn't been a revenue projection update for FY10. So we are somewhat flexible on that number, recognizing oil might be $71 or $40. We don't really know. But we are going through the policy process of targeting which sources of funds we're going to hit first. But in doing so, we've got some questions and some concerns dealing with the CBR. And we have talked about its allocation, and we kind of got to, let's just stop, let's back up and walk through the allocation again and pick up on the sub-account initially, and then we'll go from there. Okay. So we kind of fit in the process.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Jerry Burnett again. The sub-account of the sub-fund of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund is invested with a 5-year time horizon. It has a high-risk, moderately long investment horizon. It's composed of 37% fixed income, 44% domestic equities, and 19% international equities. It's had a calendar year return of negative 29.34%, 3-year actual return of negative 5.17%, but it has a target return of 7.61%. It began 2007 with a balance of $5.76 million and had an additional $4.1 billion added to it, and it now has a balance of $3.382 billion as of January 31st. To set on the record.
And then, Senator Hoffman, you had a question concerning the end of the year value initially and the end of January value.
Yes, you had made presentation to the committee, and I don't have my notes in front of me, Mr. Commissioner, on the 6 months. The 6 months estimated returns for the CBR. Do you have those with you again today?
I don't have them with me today, but what we've discussed the issue, and I think the question that you have is what is the projection for these various accounts,
the
return,
last 6 months of the fiscal year.
And what we use is basically the stated target returns as the projection for any period in the future. And so you would take that and just project it out for the remainder of the term.
And I guess my question is in light of what we have here today and what the fund how the fund has performed through January 31st, do you still anticipate the numbers to be accurate for your projections for the 6 months that you presented to the committee last week?
Well, I guess I'll answer it two different ways. First off, it is merely a projection. We are not stating the accuracy or vouching for the accuracy of it. We are stating that this is the best number available to us given the allocation that we have and the expectations that historically those assets would be expected to provide. In terms of updating the information, we intend to continue to update you with information with regard to both because we are in a, we're talking about the existing fiscal year, every day that goes by, we have a day of experience to add to the experience side and a day of forecast that, that we can drop off. And so we will provide you with continue updates of these fund balances as we move through the budgeting cycle.
The fund, I guess, had lost a little over $800 million, and for the first, the 1 month of January, it's in excess of $200 million. So the fund has lost $1 billion through December, through January 31st for the first 7 months, and. I guess the department is going to continue to invest in the same manner as it had in the first 6 months, or what is your expectation of the investments for the last 5 months of the year?
The value of any investment strategy is primarily consistency, particularly with something that is of a long-term duration. The sub-account as a sub-account will, our intent would be to remain with a similar asset allocation. I think the question that the chair raised is, are we going to, from a management standpoint, be looking at moving funds between these accounts, between the different types of asset allocations, and I think those are two different questions. The answer directly to your question is the sub-account, I would expect, will remain similarly with a similar asset allocation in the term that we're looking at.
And I guess how does that fit into the overall policy that we've adopted in the legislature, and I think the governor has adopted, that says that we're going to try to stretch these funds out as long as possible. You know, that's the first question. And with the way that the fund is being managed, what do you? I think the chairman has questioned, has raised the question of how long is that going to be if we're dipping into the CBR during the first in 09 by $1.3 billion, and potentially depending on what the price of oil is, an additional $2 billion, having dipped into the fund 50% of the fund by the end of December or July of 2011 of the 2010 fiscal year.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the what we are responsible to do is, when the budget is developed and finalized, we need to look at the constituted budget reserve and identify the appropriate mix between the main account and the sub-account. What we can anticipate at this point is where the budget process is going to end up this year in terms of the various choices that are made between where, how much the budget is going to be cut, how much is going to be needed to be taken from savings, and which of the savings accounts that's going to be taken from. We've got the statutory budget reserve. We have the constitutional budget reserve. We also have various options that the legislature has to decide upon with regard to other appropriation issues, you know, forward funding various projects. And until those are settled, we won't know ultimately what the projected fund balances of these are going to be in the time frame. We see this as an iterative process, and we see this committee and the legislature as the primary driver of this, because it's going to be through your appropriation process that you determine the use of these various funds.
Can you then explain to us how the allocation weighting was modified last year, and why it was modified?
Sure.
And how that process was implemented from a policy perspective, and then how it was physically implemented within your department.
Sure. The
and how you see the roles of the finance committees interacting with the commissioner's office.
The Constitutional Budget Reserve subaccount was created roughly 10 years ago with a statutory direction of having that fund use a target of 5 year plus for the investment horizon. The intent was to have it be more aggressively invested to provide a hopefully higher return. You can kind of take that as the inverse, that the main account is intended to cover the first 5 years before you would get to the expectation of that subaccount. And so we have watched the account balances and the projected draw on those accounts with that kind of in mind, 5 years being kind of the hurdle point. As the last couple of years have progressed, revenue has significantly increased. The draw on the reserves was seen as further out, and the reserve balances were growing. And there was a definite interest in seeing the returns on our reserve accounts be maximized in the most appropriate way, given the expected need of these various funds. So as we were entering the last budget cycle, we were talking within the department about the allocation between the main account and the subaccount. And in speaking with, at the time, Deputy Commissioner Brian Andrews and Jerry as the Admin Services Director and Ledge Liaison, what I had requested was that we basically confer with the finance co-chairs about this particular issue. Is it the desire to have the allocation basically moved, and recognizing that the main account was growing and was going to be seeing a significant deposit in the current fiscal year, to have it remain in that main account or to have it reallocated? I had a conversation almost 12 months ago in which I was asking for some feedback from the finance co-chairs in terms of how to approach this.
And who were the finance co-chairs you were talking to?
On the House side, it would have been Representative Chenault and Meyer, and on this side, it would be the current co-chairs.
So you're saying you had a conversation with me about changing the allocation of this portion of the portfolio?
I did not. I requested that that Deputy Commissioner Andrews approach the finance co-chairs about this issue. And I was looking for some feedback, and I was asking for a correspondence, basically. I was asking for some sort of a letter saying what they wanted, because in particular, I believe the House Finance co-chairs were particularly interested in seeing a more aggressive strategy with regard to the CBR as a total fund. And
what was the response from the Senate co-chairs?
I was not engaged in that direct communication. However, what came out of what I was told was the language would not come in the form of a letter. It would come in the form of budget language. And what came out of the final budget was language that was included that said they wanted the CBR deposits to be invested in a way to, I can't remember the exact language, but it was maximize return or something like that, which was communicated to us as the direction to put it into the subaccount, since there was only two choices. There was the more aggressive subaccount and there was the main account.
My recollection with the conversation with Mr. Andrews is not only no, but another word, no. So it wasn't well received in my office. That I could assure you. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner, a fundamental question. I understand how the moderate risk accounts that are being managed, either for the Permanent Fund Corporation or for TERS and PERS, I understand the decision-making process that they have, and I think we've been talking to some of the outside advisors. I mean, are there outside advisors that you turned to when you were talking about the subaccount, which is, you know, self-described here on the chart as high risk, or is this just an internal kind of thing that is accomplished through consultations with political actors?
I'm sorry, what was the last?
Or is this just is there an internal process that just, you know, that where you consult with political actors, or do you have also people like Mr. O'Leary that are advising you on investment strategies with kind of the high risk component of the subaccount?
Well, I guess my first answer would be that as far as the asset allocation is concerned, there are no consultations with quote unquote political actors. The asset allocation is developed with the investment professionals in terms of providing the asset allocation to meet what is seen as the statutory objective of that fund, which is to have returns that are targeting a five-year horizon, and to have it fairly liquid. I mean, that's still a part of the recognition that at some point these funds may be needed in a pinch, and they would have to be able to be accessed. So we don't have the diverse asset allocations associated that you see with the permanent fund or the ARM board, where you have the less liquid assets added to the mix. And so between those two positions, it's going to be the investment professionals within the department, chiefly the chief investment officer, and then he has access to a wide variety of advisors. He has regular contact with Mr. O'Leary and so forth. And so I would say that it's not where we have anybody specifically under contract, as it were, but we have full access to them in terms of developing this. When it comes to the interaction, for example, as you say, the political actors being involved, that's the question as to the allocation between the funds. And if you think about it in terms of what the state has set up, is we've set up two different funds. We've set up the longer term reserve fund with the sub account and the shorter term reserve fund.
Mr. Chair, would you be available in the morning at 9 a.m. to continue this meeting?
We had the beginning of the ARM board meeting, and I can probably come instead to this.
It'll probably just take a half hour.
And Mr. Chair, that's fine. I do understand the differences between the subaccount and the main account. I understand how investment decisions are being made on behalf of the PERS, TERS, and permanent fund, but I didn't have a good understanding of.
Yeah, and we need to go into that. That's part of the policy section. We need to go into. Does the committee want to recess and come back at 1, or do you want me to pick it up at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning?
Mr. Chair, I have a 1:30.
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. Meeting adjourned. We'll see you at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.